Hey, it's Dave McCall. And in the second of our two-part series, Colonel Heidi Heiden, godfather of the internet, concludes his amazing story on the next QTS experience.
The most valuable commodity on Earth today is data. How we make it, use it, move it, and protect it. My name's David McCall. Join me today for the QTS experience. And I remember my first real, I bought it myself, legitimate computer. I was so proud of it. I said, Dad, this thing's got a 40 megabyte hard drive. Yeah. And he looked at me like I was an idiot. What are you ever going to fill 40 megabytes with? Right, and my watch and your watch now, probably 10 times more powerful than all the computers in our neighborhood from back then.
Exactly. So, and there's GPS in this.
And there's GPS. and it's communicating with all these devices. Right. And we don't even think about it. Our neighbor where we lived right down the street from us was Jim Lovell from Apollo 13. Mm-hmm. And while I never met him personally, we heard enough conversations. And, you know, the technology that we had in those early planes and spacecraft to them was remarkable in many cases. And to us, we're like, how did anybody live? I mean, it was almost a crime to put you with that technology. And 100 years from now, 500 years from now, they're going to look back at us and say, why, how did you operate on people in that way? Why didn't you just let the nanobots run through and eat the cancer out and fix the ear? You could live to 300 years this way. I just, you know, we look back with disdain and we look forward with hope. It's kind of our nature. But what is remarkable to me that when I'm looking here, I see the modern internet.
That was done in 2 years.
That's amazing.
Now, you know what's missing here? Microsoft didn't exist.
That's right.
And so there's not much in the...
Right.
Those are dotted lines going up here to the northwest.
But they weren't far from, you know, just a few years from now that they would change this.
That started in 1984.
Yeah.
When your kids are going to get dumb if you don't buy one of these new...
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right.
And... So we did this. Now, there's one thing that I never told anybody about. There were only a few of us in the program office.
Okay.
There was one really hard thing to do.
What's that?
And so I made the I had to make the decision on whether we were going to use TCP/IP, which was taken for granted in the states that I would do.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually had to do if I was going to get ARPANET.
Mm-hmm.
But I still had that decision. And I was getting a lot of pull from the Army in Europe, who was getting a lot coming into them once they knew that this program was going for the European standards that had just been written.
Right.
And they had written a standard that did the same things TCP/IP did.
Mm-hmm.
It was a stack of manuals about this thick.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through those.
Mm-hmm.
And functionally, they did the same thing. The problem was there had been tests run with TCP/IP on DEC machines.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
No tests here.
Right. So when you say DEC machines, DEC alphas or whatever, these big, real powerful...
Well, small, real powerful.
Well, for their era.
For that day, right.
Yeah.
And because this is a little, you know, we're in the land of mainstreams and Cray computers at that time. So to make this real, first I can go out and buy packet switches.
Mm-hmm.
And I can get the real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And I can bring ATT in and upgrade all of these circuits, but only 56 kilobits. And as you pointed out, they're DES3 encrypted.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had ARPA-headed and kind of invented and BBN Bo Barrick Newman up in Massachusetts outside of Boston had built PLI, mm-hmm. a private security mm-hmm. PLI line, private line interface. Right. And now we wanted the IPLI, the Internet Private Line, because it was going to have to work not with the ARPANET protocol, mm-hmm. but with the new TCP/IP. Mm-hmm. And because we were going to build an Internet. Mm-hmm. And this was the first operational Internet. Mm-hmm. Now, for Internet to actually become an Internet and get out into the public, one simple thing had to happen. Mm. Every computer had to use TCP/IP,
right.
which none of the computer companies wanted because they all had their own private protocols.
Right.
And because you bought one mainframe from them, they sold you all the rest.
Yeah.
And the only thing that was common was terminal communications. And so I had a program where I would give them a lot of money. I put them under contract with no deliverables. Mm. But they were to spend all of this money on developing TCP/IP for them. And the other thing I did was, and I think it's in here. It's in here somewhere. But the other thing that I did was we had Secretary of Defense or the Undersecretary of Defense write one paragraph mm-hmm. that says, you will use this for all this system and mm-hmm. only this system for all your data communications.
Mm-hmm.
So I go out to industries and I say, by the way, if you want any data system, mm-hmm. that communicates, you have to have TCP/IP.
I remember when, this was a little bit later, but computer games were just sort of starting to where you were playing with, in a LAN, with other people. When my dad brought his first computer home that we were going to play, this is probably 85 or 86, I don't even know how much it cost, as much as his Ford Granada, I'm sure. Had four color monitor, which we thought was amazing. Had a dot matrix printer that if it went off now, we'd initiate the drive-by shooting program because it was so loud. But it was a single player, and it was usually a text-based game. But in the late 80s and early 90s, LAN gaming. And I remember we had all initially learned to game using IPX SPX. And as TCP/IP became more prevalent, right. where we wanted to tie into part of the internet to get to other gaming or the systems that were now connecting, we had to go out and get different network adapters that loaded it. This was back in Windows for work groups and Windows 3.1 and whatever. And we had to, or even Novell or Banyan Vines. And if you wanted to play, doggone it, you had to...
And it was probably over dial-ups.
Initially it was... we would do IPX, SPX in a little... In somebody's garage,
yeah.
Yes. Where it really caught our imagination is when groups like America on AOL, America Online, or Total Entertainment Network, or these other things really began springing up from like 92, 93 into the later 90s. And you could do everything from gaming to whatever or chat rooms. But I just remember all of us, I was in IT at the time, having to switch over. And I was just moving from desktop support into networking. Uh-huh. And we had to change all our IPS, XPX, make sure TCP/IP was loaded. And we had to learn all of the protocols.
This on had how to be to, early. 90s.
It was the early 90s.
Yeah.
It was very early 90s. We were switching over from, we had to build out our Microsoft post offices and, you know, then it was irritating. Now I look back on it with fondness because you had to edit your autoexec and your config.sys and all these other things. I hate to say the good old days because the good old days had challenges and it had great things. You know, at some point, you go back far enough, there wasn't antibiotics in the good old days. So,
right,
let's move forward. But what's remarkable to me, having been Couple things. One, your story of Heidi Heiden coming out of Oklahoma and going on this journey and solving all of these problems. And we're looking at this thing, you know, towards the end of this journey and how almost, it's almost sort of like the universe kept nudging, I need to get the right people with the right ideas, with the right perspective together, not just the technical, but the business savvy and the can-do within these constraints. Not a lot of constraints got changed for you. You had to have control. You had to have people buying into your big idea. Right. And how you just kept working this through. And now we see at the end of all of this, the beginning of the change of the world.
Right. And actually then all of the current players on the ARPANET,
right,
which is now part of the DDN,
right,
and we were building a lot of these other, running a lot of these other lines, they had, I put out the decree that if they did not have TCP/IP, mm-hmm. we were not running it on 1 January 1983. Mm. They wouldn't be able to get on the net,
right,
because I wasn't, we were running two protocols.
Right.
And I said, I was canceling the old ARPANET protocol.
Right.
And and I knew they all wouldn't.
Right.
TCP/IP in those days was very hard to integrate into an inboard mm-hmm. system. There were some outboard systems you could buy, but it was not an easy task.
Right.
And half of them made it.
Mm.
So I said, okay, for the other half, you got till July, and then I really mean it.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, we declared that to be the first operational internet, mm. and everybody went along with that.
Mm-hmm.
Now later, they're trying to work that back 1969 mm. when some...
It fits there a better narrative.
There were 100 people that were responsible right. for all that technology
right.
we used.
Right.
I was just responsible for putting it together.
Right.
The only thing we kind of made was the IPL.
Right.
And but now we had to bring it along, and in the so after 2 years, in 1984, I
mm-hmm.
retired.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody that was big in trusted computers
mm-hmm.
and computer security, which is becoming a thing,
yeah.
One started a company, and he said, let's do this together, because we're both retiring for about the same thing. He was a mm-hmm. civilian
mm-hmm.
up in command and control and operations mm-hmm. intelligence, and pretty high civilian. And so we did, the two of us, mm-hmm. and we said, okay, now what we'll do, I'll do the network security part and networking, you do computer part,
mm-hmm.
and we'll try to work together and mm-hmm. get things. But when we can't, we'll go out and we'll get our own programs,
mm-hmm.
and I'll keep 80% of what I make, you keep 80% of what you make, we'll both throw 20% into the kitty,
mm-hmm.
you know, to, mm-hmm. I said, because one thing I cannot do,
hmm.
and that's admin. I cannot stand admin. Hmm. I'll screw that up horribly.
Right.
So we got a secretary to work half
right.
a day,
right.
3 or 4 days a week. And he was way out in Maryland, and hmm. I was on the other side of Fairfax County. So we didn't get together a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, what I found myself doing is being called in to IBM, to Boeing, to Grumman, to ATT, to DRW.
Everybody, Lockheed.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Because they were bidding against a military system. So mm-hmm. that was working for me
mm-hmm.
to get them. And I said, but they... They really didn't understand this,
yeah.
and their people didn't either.
Right,
and that was especially true for IBM. Mm-hmm. And I ran the communications team for a lot of IBM proposals
mm-hmm.
Out in Shady Grove, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
to get the TCPIP part in. The last thing, and in all the technical conferences and everything else, the IBM was beating on their things. We need the European
protocols.
Be worldly, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Well, they didn't. It was just that they were so late coming, they could do their own, keep doing their own thing.
Right.
On the other hand, they needed, they had to do this. And they finally did. And I, what I learned, see, at the end of 2 years, we had about 60 people working for us. And I don't know if you had ever heard of something called the Orange Book. But that was the first security manual.
Oh, yeah.
We had one of the authors, authors of that.
Wow.
And I, a lot of people like consulting. I didn't. I was either working three jobs at a time or, oh, my God, I'm out of work.
Right, that's right.
I couldn't enjoy the downtime. And I came out of because my all my experiences in the military and schooling, I knew everything. Well, I almost immediately found out I only knew half of everything. I worked for a cost department. I didn't know what revenue was. Oh, yes, I did. It was tax money. But and now I'm working for people that are working for the the revenue side of the house, and I am learning from them. I'm just listening. And anyway, I get this one company that was one of the big protocol developers and writers of protocol software. It's called Wollongong, and they were in Palo Alto, California. And they called, they wanted me to write a business plan for them. And so I said I don't write business plans. They said, why not? I said, everybody has a different idea of what a business plan is, and yours will be different than mine. And I won't. You know, I'm not going through that. You know, I don't do that, and I hate admin anyway. I like writing plans. He says, "Well, I'm flying to London with my VP of engineering, and on the way back, we're going to stop in New York. And how about meeting us in New York? I'd like to talk to you." I said, "When will that be?" And I said, "Well, I happen to be working for Grumman out in the Queens, or not the Queens, but they're actually in Long Island." And fine, I'll be staying in Manhattan, and I'm going to have my family there. I'm going, we're going to take a little vacation. And he says, "Good. We'll stop over in between that, and we'll get a flight out the next day to California, and well, their plane was late coming in." He said, "We'll go to dinner." So they got dinner on the plane, and I'm starving to death, and 9 o'clock they say, "Can we meet?" You know, "Well, not dinner, we've already eaten." And I said, "Come by the hotel and pick," and so they do, and I said, "I haven't eaten." So where we're gonna meet is in this real deli about two blocks down the street, and it's not what you're used to. And you probably never eaten in a New York real deli. And he says, "We'll be eating on a wooden table and swatting flies, but and you get a sandwich, but I'll get a sandwich bigger than that. And by, and then I will tell you everything I know. And we'll call it a day, and you'll pay for my meal." And so at the end of that meal, they say, he says, "I've changed my mind." And I says, "Well, what are you thinking about now?" And he says, "We want to hire you." "So how can we do that? And I said, ah, that's an easy question. I can answer that question. And he says, oh, great, what? And I says, give me an offer I can't refuse. Mm. And he says, what's that? And I said, I can't answer that question until I see the offer. So they had one thing in there that sold me, because I didn't really work for money. Mm. I got well paid. Mm-hmm. And well, not in the Army. Mm-hmm. They gave you medals, and mm-hmm. but they gave you responsibility mm-hmm. and training and mm-hmm. everything else.
Yeah,
I had a lot of opportunities to leave mm-hmm. the service, mm-hmm. But then I'd be stuck where I left it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got jobs at levels that you just didn't get it in right. the civilian world.
Right.
So I made it. I loved it. And my mm-hmm. wife did too, and made a full career. But anyway, where was I going with this? Oh, so his response is, you'll be a senior vice president mm-hmm. of Wollongong, and you will have you will develop the East Coast operation from the Mississippi to the Atlantic Ocean, and we will not tell you what to do. You will tell us what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
That sentence
gotcha.
Got me. And so I worked for them for 4 years
mm-hmm.
and became about the second year vice president of all of engineering,
mm-hmm.
software engineering,
mm-hmm.
and because quite frankly, I was hiring better software engineers here
mm-hmm.
than they mm-hmm. were there,
mm-hmm.
and we were moving a lot. We were making a lot of the product here,
mm-hmm.
and we were getting a lot of business.
Mm-hmm. And what was the product that you were focusing on?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Our product was TCP/IP.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So I was still selling TCP/IP. And we made TCP/IP for DEC and all the DEC machines.
Mm.
They preferred to sell, that we sold it after, mm-hmm. but some people wanted it delivered
mm-hmm.
with,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
they bought a lot of it too. We consulted to a lot of companies. ATT bought NCR,
mm-hmm.
which by that time was a computer company, and mm-hmm. it was ATT's.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't call themselves National Cash Register Company mm-hmm. anymore. That was hardware with
right, right,
and they were down in the Raleigh area.
Right,
we built a Unix TPC for them.
Right,
and provided that, and we worked with a lot of companies, and this started getting this going. That was 86 to 1990. In 1990, I get a call from second largest broker dealer in Wall Street, and they say, we want to interview you,
mm-hmm.
and we want to hire you. Come
mm-hmm.
up. And,
mm-hmm. Now, up to this point,
yeah.
the infrastructure that you're rolling out TCP/IP integration into this hardware and this infrastructure, was this mostly for systems that were going into universities, going into telecom? I mean, I don't remember a lot of consumers trying to figure out how to get this into their laptop. It sounds like the systems you're talking about was primarily.
Well, we called ARPANET the experimental net.
Right.
All right. And we made pretty good deal. We made better deals than ARPA did with research centers and especially New York State,
mm-hmm.
Which eventually privatized. They were one of the first ones privatized their communication system,
mm.
but they'd adopted pretty mm-hmm. much everything we were doing,
mm-hmm.
and that company was called PSI,
mm.
which became a pretty significant company.
Right, yeah.
And I was one of their first customers as East Coast Operations Director for Wollongong.
Right.
Because I helped, they gave me the contract to sign, because I was going to use them for my internet, and I said, this is no contract.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're being too. It doesn't work for you as a business.
And right.
With them, the lawyers, I helped them rewrite the contract. Became very good friends with them.
Mm.
And they were just getting started. So that's in the late 80s, mm-hmm. Probably 88. And to get the internet off the ground and to get it really into more significant places so there'd be more material out there, we needed two things. We needed better interface. And
I'm just want to make note about this.
We needed a better interface, and we need, as I started in beginning, everybody to have TCP/IP. So for 6 years now, I've been working on, as a civilian, mm-hmm. on pushing TCP/IP mm-hmm. out. Now I'm working with a protocol company to do that, and head of software engineering. I mean, that's their only product, the software. Right. And that was going pretty well, pretty good. Now I get this call from Wall Street, and I say, why do you want to interview mm-hmm. me? And they said, we're moving from Water Street into a new building, World Trade Center number 7, mm-hmm. 50 half-height building of the mm-hmm. 1 and 2, and we've got over half that building and all new equipment and everything else, and management wants to use internet technology, and we were having real troubles with that. And we brought in some specialists, mm-hmm. consultants, and they said, you know, you don't need a consultant. You need a guy here to run that. Mm-hmm. And they said, you're the guy. Mm. So I go up there, and long story short, at the end of the day, I said, you know, this is all pretty good. I'm real excited about what you're doing.
Right.
It was Solomon Brothers.
Right.
And they were the biggest bond company, but also did... which was called fixed income, which also did equities, which is stocks. That mm-hmm. The largest stock broker was Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. And these were real brokers.
Right.
And then there are eight others, three more big ones, and they And those 10 depended on 710 independent mom-and-pop shops, the small
right.
companies, broker-dealers company, to actually medium-sized broker-dealer companies, because that's where they got their business. Mm. They bought from the big guys, mm-hmm. as well as big guys selling the little guys.
Right.
That's on our intent was very important to them. Mm. And so the 10 built this training center, mm-hmm. called SIA, Securities Industries Association, that taught them trading, finance, how to be a better dealer, how to tie in with Wall Street, and technology.
Mm.
And they, so I became. As a secondary job, mm-hmm. I became chairman of the technology mm-hmm. group, and I was kind of off staff. And they had they would have about 25 from the 700s come in at a time for a month's stay,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I'd go over and talk to them, tell them what we were doing. And I told them that Solomon had become the leader in this, and everybody else was now following our lead.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the resources to take in new equipment, test it before put it out or send it back and say do this.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of new technologies coming along, and anything we bought, other people bought because it had been tested.
Mm.
And they didn't have the staff or the money, and especially these 700 didn't have staff and money mm-hmm. to buy. They had to buy what we were doing.
Right.
And I said, I believe in open systems and I believe in open houses. And the way we stay ahead, and you have to catch up. And I'll tell you everything you need to know to try to catch up. Because I want the stock technology to keep going and going and going.
Right.
This is the technology. And it's catching on. Now, during the first part of this, Berners-Lee wrote what became the Mosaic interface. And then, now we were having people that could really use this.
Now, explain why the Mosaic interface was a big deal.
It made it easy to use.
Right.
It made it easy to use for people who wanted to put their stuff on the internet, and it made it use for mom, pop, and their son that's going to grow up dumb if he doesn't learn how to do this.
Right.
Well, that was what everybody was selling this stuff on.
Right. That's right.
And then I go to Holmes, and it was up in the closet. Anyway.
That's exactly right.
So 1984, really, first IBM DOS computer came out, and first really Apple computer came out. They had Apple II and everything, but people in the know were using those. And before that, you built your own computer and integrated a monitor with it and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But now when I had to buy the computer and get a dial-up network, AOL came in, it was taking form. And it's becoming usable and more usable and more usable, and it's starting to grow. And so I was doing what I need to do to, you know, to make computer companies get better at doing this. And computer companies would come to us trying to sell their new products because we'd tell them what was wrong with it. I completely reorganized that. I told them I'd stay there 2 years. I wasn't moving there. They said, you have to move there. And I got an apartment in Hoboken. They had a technical center in something field. I forget what they call it. But it's where a racetrack was and where the Giant Stadium was. Anyway, and then there's a tech center out there. And Solomon Brothers had a three-story building with more mainframes. And the reason that Solomon wanted to get on the internet is they were tired of paying IBM all this money for mainframes and the everything else.
Right.
So I told him, look, I'm going to leave here in 2 years, and you're really going to have your own network, but you're also going to have those mainframes. Don't kid yourself.
That's right. We still see them out there. They got the mainframes. They've got the minis. They're still working.
And in those days, in the 80s and the early 90s, there were all these computer companies.
Right.
The only name that lived was IBM.
Right.
Honeywell doesn't make them anymore.
Xerox doesn't make them anymore. Nobody.
Cray's still out there in a different way. They were the supercomputer. Okay, so I said, I'm going to leave in 2 years. And so, and I already had, I was in charge of security, charge of a whole bunch of stuff. Charge of the mainframe. And my title was senior operating officer. And so I was senior because I'm older than all you people. God, I was starting my 50s. I thought that was old.
I used to think it was old, too. That was a while ago.
And they kept giving me other jobs. I started a company, one of their companies. I forget what we called it now. And all it did... I got together with four others that I get to got to know who's had my job in the other companies.
Right.
And we get together because I said, you know, in a lot, we don't compete in a lot. We don't compete for our telephone systems.
Right.
We all buy from one of two companies.
Right.
And a third one that might want to get in.
Right.
Well, and a third one. MCI was getting kind of big then. And we all buy the same stuff. And we all compete it out. And we all get good deals on that because then they sell it to... I said, but we could get a real good deal if we one company and bought it. So I've got this company that you'll all be partners in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll have a guy, one of my VPs, separately run it. That'll be a full-time job for him.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll write proposals for routers, for the stuff we all use, and get better pricing. Because if we don't buy it, no one will buy it. If we do buy it, everyone will buy it. We did that. And a lot of the major companies didn't like it because they liked to sell us to us individually.
Right.
But and they didn't like to sell to us at a discount that wasn't profitable. But they would make a lot of money if they did. And anyway, things like that. And then they kept giving me more money, so I stayed for 5 years. And by that time, Wall Street was becoming something different. They wanted to get out of the SEC rules and get into banking rules. And we started coming to banks, and they started merging, and it started.
Right.
And I said, it's time for me to get back to Fairfax County. And at that time, I recognized that the internet had probably hit the bottom of the curve, exponential curve. I said, this sucker's going, it got everything it needs to take off. And I had a job waiting for me, and it was from the company that wanted to do bank credit card banking on the internet. He was the guy that when you went to Macy's and ran your Stripe card through the thing. He was the guy that made those. And that was the company that invented it in California.
Right.
He retired Fairfax County and was pretty well doing. He started this other company and it to do that, make that same kind of thing happen on the internet. So people could shop on the internet and pay on the internet. And that was, the name of the company was CyberCash. It's a private company. And his name is Bill Melton. And so I said, okay, but I'm going to take two months off after commuting to New York for 5 days a week. And I said, first month just to be with my family. Second month, we're going to take a cruise to Alaska and some other stuff. In the meantime, my son, Clint, had gone to work. He graduates in 1990 and goes to work for this company that, of all things, is making TCP/IP for Macintosh computers.
Did you know that before he went there, that that's what it was going to be about? Did he talk to you about it?
I made... daughter and son. Daughter's no longer with us, but she was 4 years his senior, and she went to University of Virginia, and he went to James Madison. And they do anything they wanted as long as their minor was in some kind of computer science, technical course. Well, they both wound up in, I said, because in business, when by the time you graduate, you got to know that stuff.
That's right.
And, well, so when he graduated, he says, I've got two really good offers, I think. He said one was with a computer, it was with NCR. And I said, I'm very familiar with them. They're a good company. It's a good group. They're on the Unix system. That's pretty good. And the other one is this guy that started a company with a credit card and two employees. He's got TCP running, selling TCP on the Macintosh. Now, the popular thing on that was terminal. They were really buying it for the terminal.
Right.
And dial in. And and he says, what do you think? I said, well, one's a job. But it's just a job.
Right.
The other one's entrepreneurial.
Right. It's an adventure.
And they want to bring you in on the sales team. How big's that sales team, by the way? He says, I'll be the third one, I think, something like
right.
that. And so he works with them for 4 years, and this company called UUNet gets a contract, gets funded by two venture capital companies, one in California and one here. They want to make this UUNet is Unix to Unix. And they want to make this to become an internet company. And to do that, they need to build, but they need to build a bigger team and bring internet into this and build up their sales. So someone that knew the this Apple interface company. Which kind of had grown a little bit, said, the guy you need to, then they had four salespeople at UUNet, and they needed to be managed. He said, you need to hire Clint. So he came over when they were a private company, and that was the year before I actually went in. But anyway, this is not going well because Clint can sell more than they can make. And their internet things are not working too well.
Right.
And they're starting to get a kind of a bad reputation, and they've gone public. So this is not looking good. And the CEO says, Clint, what do we do? And he says, you need to hire my dad. I said, Clint, who's running engineering there now? He says, this guy's friend from IBM. And I says, you don't hire anybody from IBM to run an internet company. They can't even spell the word.
Right.
I said, no wonder you're having a problem. They said, he's a good old Joe. And he says, well, that's his name, Joe. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to work for Mel on CyberCash, and they want me to be Mr. Inside. I think in all these companies they have Mr. Outside and Mr. Inside, regardless of title.
And the same today.
If you're a public company, especially true, he's got to work all the public stuff.
And
the inside guy can run the inside, but that's not really a COO. They usually have him running operations.
Right.
And anyway, we're coming back from Clint calls me somehow on the ship, and he says, Sedgemore wants to talk to you. CEO of the new CEO of UUNet. And I say, well, let's wait until we dock. We're going to spend some time in Seattle, and I'll call him from there. So he wants to interview me, and I said, well, I'll be back in a week, and we'll do it then. But, John, I've already got a job, and it's a good one. And I'm I'm going to take over their inside operation. Mm-hmm. And he said, how'd you get that job? And I said, well, it just so happens that the engineer that runs that job worked for me with the equivalent of MITRE, in the Air Force equivalent of MITRE, when I was on GPS program, and now he's running their engineering shop. He's a really good guy. And he told them to, I'm sorry, someone that used to work for me from Wollongong with salespeople had a new mountain, and the mountain tells him he needs to get a an inside. Anyway, he gets a new CEO. And he said, well, this guy you want to hire, but he doesn't want to be a CEO. He wants to be Mr. Inside. And so he asked the head of engineering, you know, what about this guy? Have you ever heard of him? He says, yeah, I know him. And you couldn't do better. So I'm going to work, you know. I interview with them and all. Okay, so long story short is I come back, and my real heart is with the internet.
Right.
And Sidgemore says, have you talked about this to Clint? And I said, no. I'm here. He says, I come see you. And so he's got this big whiteboard, and he says, well, let me show you by how we're organized, what our problems are. And he
writes it out.
And he says, now let me tell you what our problems are. And I said, John, how about I tell you what your problems are? And he said, so you have talked to Clint. I said, no. Or how can you do that? I say, you just put them up on that chalkboard. And every time you have a problem, you put a new group under you.
Right.
I said, and you can't manage them. And you don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, yeah, you need a Mr. Insight.
Right.
And that's what I do.
Mm.
And but I've already got a job.
Right.
He says, tell me what I need to beat them. And I said, make me an offer and I'll tell you if it does. And I'll come back tomorrow. And he says, yeah, best I can do. And I said, you failed. You get an F today. Anyway, he's talking to someone who wanted to work, do that anyway.
Right.
And so I do. And I said, okay, I'm going to completely reorganize all of this, and I want control of everything except this thing and this thing. And he said, why those two things? And I said, the people that run that are your friends, and I don't want to have to deal with that, and I don't want to have to deal with those two entities. Okay, because that's not where your problems are. And one of them was running a startup data company, a data center thing.
Right.
So this is really the start of that.
Right.
And the only reason I said hang on to that is because AT&T had just invested $5 million into getting into that business. And I said, wait a minute. There's something there. And we just have this little video. Anyway.
Right.
I told John, I said, I'm going to bring down some people who work for me at Solomon. I said, I'm going to bring down two. And now that I know what's going on here, and now that I know I don't get along with your CFO, and I'm going to start a little thing called a business management group. And it's the same person that ran my business management group at Solomon. She worked in Solomon. She didn't work for me. She just supported me full time. And I'm going to allow each one of those to bring a person down. And the other one was a guy that I kind of invented a new way to do these things. That was my system engineering. Guy, and he did not do operations. Another guy did operations. I'm going to do that here. And because operation guys don't like to bring in new stuff. Everything's going fine.
Right.
I don't want that new thing to come in here.
That's right.
And the system engineering isn't bothered by operations, and he's going after the new stuff.
Right.
And all I have to do is monitor the fight between two of them, make a decision.
Right.
So it makes my job a lot easier.
Right.
And so I brain down that guy from here. He mm-hmm. brains down one of his top guys, and he's really a top guy, both of those top guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I brain down my finance person. She brains down really tight, and she's really tight. And I said, okay, now your job is to run a business organization, and this part of the organization is going to work for you too. You're going to oversee that. But what I need from you is I want you to make friends with the people in the finance mm-hmm. office, because I can't get what I need out of them because of the CFO mm-hmm. they work for. But you make friends with them because mm-hmm. they're really good people,
mm-hmm.
and you'll get what you need.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to know what we're spending.
Mm-hmm.
MCI has that all mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know how to depreciate the new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's on too long. They get stuck with depreciating equipment they can't use anymore, mm-hmm. and they still have to,
mm-hmm.
anyway, spend money depreciating
on it. No great coincidence there is right. no MCI anymore.
Huh?
No great coincidence there is no MCI anymore, and had a big debacle probably not long after this conversation.
Well, we bought MCI.
Oh, did you?
Okay, right. Now, not now, not
right.
yet. I want to keep the operational cost that close to the revenue.
Right.
And so just about the time I get all that together,
mm-hmm.
The CEO makes a deal with, for some reason I keep forgetting their name, but one of the big cable mm-hmm. company. And new cable is necessary for what everybody's
right.
coming. So these cable companies are very significant, very well funded. This one comes out of Omaha. And they buy us. They merge with us. Two public companies merging. And we're with them. But the deal is we're independent. But we'll use them to buy all the cable that they can provide us.
Mm-hmm.
We will not be their only vendor
mm-hmm.
because they can't.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can provide us everything that we need, fine.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, we get to do what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this relationship is developing over 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And WorldCom, who is running by a crook named Bernie Ebbers, has
well documented crook.
In the end, but as Bill buys another company, starts with a small company,
right,
and buys another company, and then starts a telephone company,
right,
that's larger than he. Every year, over the past 14 years, or maybe 13, and he has 13 companies. Now he takes the best people out of those companies, but only the best two or three,
mm-hmm.
and gets the customer base and the resources and integrates that with what he already has,
mm-hmm.
and gets some new pretty good managers.
Mm-hmm.
But you cannot integrate 13 different financial systems into you as you go along with
right.
the more companies coming in, the worse that gets.
Right.
So he hires a company that gives him a clean slate because what they see is okay.
Right.
And then he goes to Solomon Brothers, where I came from, and kind of by his other analyst somehow, I don't know much about that, who keeps recommending WorldCom. So their stock keeps going up. Mm. And then they decide they need they had bought a large networking company that was being run out of Tulsa. It was a company that used its, it was funded by an oil company that used their unused pipe as real estate to run cable. It's already there.
Right.
It's underground.
Right.
Can't pump oil through it anymore.
Right.
We'll
run glass.
We'll run.
Yeah.
And it was called Williams. Yeah. Anyway, he buys Williams. Hmm. He gets a really good top engineer from that, and he makes him a head engineer for them. And they say, we need to buy that cable company. Bernie buys a cable company, not knowing that he's really dragging along an internet company. Now, Bernie doesn't type, he doesn't write, he doesn't write to-do notes. There is no record of what Bernie tells his people to do. And he doesn't want any. Because if anything happens, it's your fault you made that decision. I just suggested it. And so that's good for us because these people understand that Unionet's going to be separate. But once Bernie's starting to find out about this, and we're growing exponentially. Our network's growing 10x a year, revenue's growing 5x a year, employment's growing 2x a year. Clint is selling in a different way. He wants someone who's really good, all around person, has technical training, just coming out of college, and he'll train him. And he puts them on a three-month program. They graduate from that, they go to another 3-year. If they graduate from that, they turn over those hard jobs for the other ones. We start growing. And now we're a public company, so for the first 6 months, we had to make a profit. So I started running the company to do that, and just staying. Clint and I really ran the company. He would sell, and I would build, and I wouldn't build any faster than he would. He would sell. Now he would sell ahead, but he didn't get revenue during that period.
Right.
So I knew what this revenue was. And so we were always profitable. And then when we merged with the cable company, we were still independent, but it was now a different company. And we did the same thing and helped keep them profitable. So now we've got the greatest rate of profit in all of these companies that had come together. Our CEO becomes president of the other company and vice chairman. Now WorldCom buys. Our CEO becomes president of their company. He wants to make me president, but by that time, Bernie and I know each other and can't stand each other. So he says, you can make him acting vice president. I want him to know he can go any day, I say so. It didn't matter. And he also, so he became president of the cable company and vice chairman of WorldCom. So he was advancing himself, really. And in the meantime, we were really going out And Bernie buys MCI. And Sage Moore comes back to me, says, we bought MCI, and all the telephone pieces go in here, and we're going to give you all of the the internet pieces. And I said, I don't want those pieces. And he says, why? And I said, well, I already know that we're twice as big as they're. We're the largest internet company now, and we're twice as large as the company we just built, bought, and they're number two, and maybe more than twice. I said, he says, I didn't know you're that much bigger. I said, I'm a bigger customer with their cable division than their internet division is. He takes me to their conferences on a private MCI plane. Yeah. I'm a big customer there, and the rest of MCI hates us, but that's okay. And there's some they have some really good people, some really sharp. I said, don't want any of that. All I want is their customer base. And he says, what do I do with this? And I said, John, you sell it. You're good at that. So cable and wireless was wanting into the USA cable and wireless division of cable and wireless. Was wanting to go into, get bigger in the internet stuff. And so Sage Moore sells them all of this. And this is about the time that dot-com is starting to happen. And prices for these companies is coming down. So they, Cable Wireless thinks that they find this at a really good price. We are hands-on the biggest. We start drifting into the wholesale business, but also I've got this telephone dial-up service that I can't stand. It's very hard for them to be profitable, and it's a very problematic thing for the guy that's running it to keep on top of it, and he keeps getting new equipment. Now, we sell directly to the users. We are Microsoft MSN's company providers. They sell, and but we're the operational part of it. We have this contract with them that we wrote. They were too busy to write us a contract, so Sage Moore wrote the contract, and it was it's the only favorable contract that someone has gotten out of Microsoft. And we get a third to half of AOL's business. But then we merge the other third, and now we've got two thirds of it. And dial-up's tough, and it's tough to make a profit. And I didn't want any more dial-up. So we keep but we have this new customer base, and we have a new dial-up customers. So that makes that part of the problem harder. By now, I've got 10 years, five with Solomon Brothers, and about four with UUNET, almost four. And during those years, I've been Cisco's largest customer by far. I knew John, their chairman, when he was vice president of that. Mm. Solomon Brothers were the first one to go internet inside the company, and we had 400 routers.
Right.
Then none of, and we had two firestorms a day, where everybody's systems went down. And I was calling John, starts with the C. We didn't get along. He believed that the router company knew more than the user about the internet. Mm-hmm. So he was designing routers that he knew we would need. Mm-hmm. We were telling him what we needed. Mm-hmm. And
but that's not an uncommon conundrum. I mean, it's not unique to the internet business. You know, I remember somebody talking about Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and some other folks, and they didn't always get it right, but they got it right enough. But
two entirely personalities, though.
Yeah, but they would bring a swagger and a thing and a whatever, and you know, when it didn't work, it didn't work. But I guess my point is, when you're, I don't know the chairman of Cisco, okay. But
It didn't work was the CEOs of General Motors doing the 50s. In the early 60s, that we're going to make you the car you want,
right.
And we know you like style and pretty.
Right.
Doesn't matter if you get a little rust on it when you buy it new.
Right. And, well, what shook that up, I remember what shook it up, at least for me, was...
Well, the Japanese.
The Japanese.
You bet.
And here's why. Because
and they didn't learn from that.
They didn't learn from that. But after a while, somebody asked me... probably a decade into buying Japanese vehicles. Why was I doing that? We have a long history of my family. I'm like, because when I get in this vehicle, I feel like from the one that I owned, you know, a generation or two before this, they're constantly adjusting the ergonomics for me. They're constantly, you think it's about fuel economy or whatever. I'm telling you, they know me better than you know me and what I like and how I like to drive, and I can afford it.
But what's between you and them? A dealer. They do not like dealing with you.
Right.
That is the dealer's problem.
Right.
If the dealer doesn't do a good job, well, they become in disfavor and don't get the popular colors.
Right. That's right.
And so they were kind of removed. Microsoft was the same way.
Right.
They did not like to deal with people they dealt with.
Right.
Anyway, I won't go into all that
because
I probably now am going to get a lot of new enemies from your podcast.
Nobody.
But I'm just telling you, this is the way the world was then. And these are all new people, and the world has changed and has moved on.
It is interesting to think, like, I'm a fan of Cisco. It is interesting to think, though, especially in the era of recent gas pipeline issues and other ransomware stuff around meatpacking, that the infrastructure of the internet is dominated by a manufacturer and a OS. Not picking on them, but if you can exploit vulnerabilities in something that's 60%, 80%, depending upon who you ask, of internet infrastructure, certainly in the West, and we're all thinking about that now.
Well, I always make my system engineer to be able to tell me what he needs a year from now.
Mm-hmm.
And in a business that's going as fast as us, it's tough.
Yeah.
But they learned how to do that at Solomon's Brothers.
Right.
And because I made him do it. Mm-hmm. And I hired the guy that knows how to do it now. And we have visions about a year out.
Mm-hmm.
And we know what we need.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the router and the cores were probably good for half to three quarters of a year, and we have to move them in.
Mm-hmm.
Cisco has to give us a bigger router.
Mm-hmm.
And then I hit the wall with them. I'm dealing with their local salesperson, and I deal once a quarter with their CEO.
Mm-hmm.
But she comes in, and we're getting ready to write a new letter of intent for buys.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I will. Oh, and then the other thing that's always an argument is I want a 1% discount. That's all.
Right. That's right.
I'm your biggest customer. Right. I want another 1%.
Right.
Sorry. And so she comes in and I say, okay, I'm going to sign a letter of intent for $50 million for you. It says, I intend to buy that many routers from you next year. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest order you've ever had as a company.
Mm-hmm.
I want my 1%. Well, it comes back, and no. And by the way, we're not going to build a router to the spec you say you need a year from now.
Mm.
Now, I've got one of the best, I'm sorry, I've got this guy running the system engineering stuff. But I've got one of the best technical guys in the business.
What year would you say this is?
This is running 95 to 2000.
Okay.
And absolutely, his name is Mike Odell.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely one of the sharpest guys.
His name's Michael Dell?
Odell.
Odell.
You know,
I'm
Mike,
with you. No, I thought you said Michael Dell from Dell Computers.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
No.
But Michael Odell is running this. Okay, I'm with you.
Very well known.
Right.
And he knows Cisco and they know him. And the lead engineer from Cisco, the lead router designer engineer, is leaving Cisco and going with four other people to form a company named Juniper.
Oh.
And they're from separate companies.
Yeah.
One guy's got management experience, one guy's got sales. And,
yeah, I know Juniper well.
Huh?
I know Juniper Networks well.
Well, they have, and the guy that's in the East Coast happens to run the marketing sales, or will be, of Juniper. And they're funded by Kleiner Perkins. And he's coming down, and he's come down to see me, and we're going to talk. And, we know each other, and I'd like for you to come in that meeting and get to know him.
Mm-hmm.
So I get to know him, and I said, could you come back tomorrow? This is kind of how the story goes. I want to talk to you some more. So I go up to legal, and I said, I need a letter for a $5 million product within the next year. I need a contract or a letter. I need a contract. From a company called Juniper. And then a letter that we would like to have, Kleiner Perkins, that we would like to have $5 million worth of their stock. Although they're getting all the money they need from secondary investors and Kleiner, who's the biggest king on the hill, as far as venture capitalists go. And so he comes back next day, and I said, here's a signed contract, if you'll sign it. We want to buy $5 million worth of your products. We don't have any products. I said, well, here's a spec. Build that, and I'll buy $5 million worth of that. And be your first customer, because the hardest thing isn't money now.
Right.
You've got $5 million more than you need.
Right.
The hardest thing is finding your first customer.
Right, your anchor tenant. Right, your anchor
customer. And I'm not only telling you that you got him.
Right.
I'm telling you what he wants.
Right.
You build that, and you've got the best engineer.
Right.
You build that, and you got a deal.
Right.
So, well, that was good. So we put the word out that, and he says, well, what about pricing? We don't even know what they cost. I said, contract says I want 35% off catalog cost. Mm-hmm. That's a fair deal.
Mm-hmm.
And something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the details very well. But
it wasn't outrageous. It was
Now they're going. Right. Kleiner says, we would like for you to be an outside, there's a name for this, mm-hmm. and we do it, an outside board member. In other words, I don't vote and I don't get any money, mm-hmm. but we want you to come to our board meetings mm-hmm. once a quarter
mm-hmm.
In California.
Mm-hmm.
And so I make sure that Cisco knows that we're going to buy
right.
off the contract, off the spec they wouldn't agree to.
And did the Christmas cards keep rolling in?
And that's going to be the fastest, biggest, largest guy on the street out. So I start going to their mm-hmm. their quarterly meetings, and I have a lot of projects for experience. Mm-hmm. I have never seen a project this well run.
Mm.
To build, for the first time, the biggest router that's mm-hmm. ever been built.
Mm-hmm.
And they're on schedule, they're on cost, and I'm cheering them on, and Kleiner loves me because we're really into this.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm into it because there's no way we can lose.
Mm-hmm.
I've got competition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for the first time,
right.
I have competition.
Right.
And we had to build it ourselves.
Right.
And so anyway, not too long after that, I retired.
Mm.
Bernie and I really can't get to where he comes down. He has a guy come down and find out how much coffee we're building, we're buying, and how many coffee cups we're buying.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Your guys are stealing coffee."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you'll need three times that many cups at least
mm-hmm.
to use that much coffee.
Mm-hmm.
You have guys stealing. What else? You know, you're gonna. You're gonna
that's when a relationship is just gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I said, Bernie, look around. Most guys have got their own mug on the desk and four others from other companies. That's a big deal. They swap right. mugs. They look right. at whose mug I'm drinking out of
right.
today. Guests get the, right. the styrofoam cups.
Right.
Anyway, it was things like that.
Mm-hmm.
HR comes down and he says, here is WorldCom's new travel policy and we have to. And I mm-hmm. said, Diane, put that in safe and lock it there and don't tell anybody that
mm-hmm.
here that we're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, somehow he found out about that. But anyway, I say I'm going to retire
mm-hmm.
In 9 months,
mm-hmm.
and I want to make sure that my guys are well taken care of, and I also want in my next stock bonus mm-hmm. that will come in 9 months, and then mm-hmm. I'm completely out.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell HR I'm only going to be here 10% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I only want 10% of my salary. Mm-hmm. So all that's working out.
Mm-hmm.
And during that, I'm getting offers from Kleiner to do some work for them, and some other things, essentially I'm flunking retirement before I've retired, I get on a lot of entrepreneurial boards, and one's a real go-getter, and it's a company up in New York City being run by a pretty good guy in Manhattan. But that's there are a lot of work, and all that. Well, a lot of them just want is my name on the board sheet, I think, and they'll run the company. The one in New York wants to go public or get bought is funded by a venture capital and has two independent and they want two independent people on the board. So they get a guy from IBM and me. And we do a lot of work for them. That was interesting and fun, but then I'm totally retired from UnionNet, and Kleiner, one of their partners, says, "We're putting together this program. I want you to look at it, and we want you to run the program and be CEO of the company, really, and we'll fund the initial part of it." And so I look at this, and I give it back to him, and I said, "There's no way that's going to be exist. Right. I don't care who's running it.
Right.
I'm sorry, but I'm not taking that job."
Right.
So I don't. And it's the nickname for the company is BBO, Business Office Something. And I won't go into any details of that, but 6 months, it's about a year later. And boy, they're headed down the hill like this. And the dot-coms are doing triage on all of the companies that they've been funding because they've got shed some.
Right.
But these are their own patients.
Right.
They don't know which ones to kill.
Right.
They loved them all. Right. Yeah. And back then, it wasn't profit didn't matter. It's how many customers you got.
Right.
And so that's the period we're in. So. Remember that second guy I brought down to UNED in engineering? He is the president. Oh, so he talks them into separating the pieces because he knows the good piece. And he's president of this company. And you know the sales guy I told you about, Clint? He's the sales guy. And I look at this product, and it's really good. And then the rest, the other half, is on their own. And we know where that's going. And I don't know whether this company's got a chance or not, but I sign up and as a CEO and chairman, and we've got 250 people. A week later, we have 200. And Clint's doing well in sales. People like what we're doing. They like us at a company. But the company's got $40 million in debt that it's pulled over as its half of the. And with who's going to invest in the company when all the investors are doing triage on their own company? So we go around hitting Wall Street, and we have M&A person from Wall Street, happened to come from Salomon Brothers. And we had a lot of people that I hired when I was there, you know, and now they have bigger jobs. We have this, we're not getting bites. They have their own problems. They'd like to, but they study the problem. And then we get this one Texas company that's an oil company. And it's the third largest oil company in Texas. And they come up to see us and they say, well, we'd like, we're thinking about buying you. So we get our team together. Why? Well, we want to be as big as what's the E company in Texas that was an oil company?
Ross Perot's company?
No.
The E company.
Come on, Chevron, Esperon.
Enron.
Enron.
Yeah.
Enron's making a killing.
Right.
They're putting new oil.
Right.
Yeah, I said, I know this company has some of this.
Right.
Their product.
Right.
It's not a product.
That's right.
It's worthless. Right. I will.
It's a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah. Right. I said, it are pieces of unused cable.
Right.
But not on either end. Right. And they're selling it. They're selling stock in that company. I said, and that's what you want to do. I want you to come up with a product that puts us in the money like Enron's putting in the money. Buy us and we'll make you that money. No, you don't understand. And I says, one of us doesn't. Right. But this is going on. We right. like each other, right. And this is going on. But we keep saying no. We are not going to cough out a phony product. You know, and
in your whole history of all the things that you've talked about, there's been obstacles to be overcome. There's been unrealistic expectations, but there hasn't been any funny products, right? It's been highly integrity, intense problems to overcome if they can be overcome,
right.
Systems to be developed and deployed, but not not something that in all the conversation you've talked about, there's nothing that you've talked about that at some point you didn't believe in. I believe in the people, I believe in the idea, I believe in the methodology, and when you get into something like this, you're like, that's not a real thing.
I'm going to repeat something that Clint's already said publicly, but he goes to his mother and says, how am I going to follow Dad's shoes? And, how do I do that? So my wife says, your dad's not the smartest guy in the room. And he makes mistakes. And blah, blah, blah. But there's one thing he's got that a lot of other people don't have. And that everybody wants to work for him. So you be the person everybody wants to work for and go get him.
And the reason why they want to work for you
is because I'll make their ideas come true.
Right.
Or they'll make my ideas come true.
Right.
You know, these are people I've put, and I got to where I got to know people who were, they're all through industry that are, you're not using everything that, you're not using 10% of what this guy has. And he's, you're paying new people coming in at his job more than you're giving him for a seniority. You're not going to have him that long. But anyway, I'll hire him and I'll give him something to do, and he'll perk up like that. And when I went to Union, I said, you know, there are some of you people that are already here don't like your jobs, and I know that. Because I listened to the water fountain. And, my office is in my shoes, my size 15 shoes. I walk around, and you know, and I get to know you. And so, but you have to, but you can't quit because you have a health problem. You can't quit, but you start out at the bottom at this new thing you'd love to do. I said, just come to me and tell me you don't like your job, and I'll ask you, what do you want to do here? And I'll put you into that job. If you work out, you're here.
Right.
And we didn't, and things like that get around. We didn't have a hiring company. We ran an ad in the Wall Street, we ran it in the Washington Post. And every other Saturday morning, 9 to noon, in this building, we had a hiring session. Come in, bring your resume, and later we'll tell you if you have a job. We didn't have to advertise.
Right.
And every Saturday, we had people that come in and want to work for us. And that was... by word of mouth and our reputation as a company, but the people that already word of mouth from the people that already worked there. It was really a good group.
Reminds me of similar idea, what you're describing, how you lead people. Good friend of mine recently retired as CEO of Accenture Digital, and his name's Mike Sutcliffe. At one point in his org, he probably had 40-something thousand people just in that division. I have randomly met many people in the world that didn't know that I knew Mike. And we'd get having a conversation about Accenture. And, you know, if you're a consultant, that's a tough gig, a lot of pressure, and, you know, whatever. Secretly, I would, as I would talk to folks, I was trying to set them up. Without exception, dozens of people over the years loved this guy, loved his organization. And Mike wasn't a taskmaster at all, but he was just serious about, you know, the people with the most money and the most talent have to call somebody when they get stuck. They call somebody like Mike.
Yeah.
And they show up very serious about getting their job done. And yet, regardless of the age or the ethnicity or the education of these different groups of people that worked with him over the years, the thing that they had in common was a lot like what you described, which was, how do I help you, if you've got the talent, if you've got the intellectual ability, if you've got the work ethic, you just may not have the right fit yet. If we can find the fit, and it's interesting to me to help you find the fit, because if I can have people of high character around me, like that's what I want to build. They had so much, and people say this all the time, so take it with a grain of salt, but I genuinely believe he means it, and I do mean it. When you find people who love each other, they build a community, they feel like they're about something, that have a team, and sometimes that love's expressed by, you know, it can get, it's a little, what do they call it?
Well, another company like that is QTS.
It is. I'm employee number 32 here, and I absolutely believe, and this isn't an infomercial for QTS, but I 100% believe. It's not that, you know, the leaders here don't have sometime full contact interactions, but even in my jump unit, even my other military units, you know, people re-enlist because they don't want to, especially in times of combat, because they don't want to leave their brothers or sisters behind. They want to maintain that. And when organizations, when leaders figure out how to do that, it's like magic.
And in the Army, the lowest ranking leader is a team chief.
Yeah, that's exactly
right. That's his title.
That's exactly
right. And that's where it starts.
Yeah, small teams.
But when I was at Wollongong, and you know, we were building up from scratch. I hired everybody that was on the East Coast, And we became 90% of their product, really. And quite a bit of their sales but that was due to the West Coast, too. And West Coast still had a good engineering team. I'm not dissing that. But I tell people, look, you do not work from 9 to 5. If I see you coming in at 9 and leaving at 5, there's something wrong here.
Right.
If you don't have anything to do, go home.
Right.
Because there are going to be days in here where I got you working all weekend.
Right. Absolutely right.
I'll get that time back.
Right. Absolutely.
Because we've got problems, or we've got a problem being we've got a challenge here for a new job or something, you know. And it's got a time schedule, and we need to get this done. And you have a team that comes in and does it.
Right.
I mean, otherwise you'd have people that come in to do it.
Well, it's like the trades. You know, my grandfather, who survived the Great Depression, went on to be a P-51 pilot in World War II. Yeah. When he came back, he went to Purdue full-time at night while six kids during the day. So a full-time job, you know, 3 hours of sleep. And when he finally got his engineering degree, relocated his whole family to the Bay Area. He had his tonsils removed without anesthesia. Both of his parents were Marines in the 20s. I mean, this is pioneer stock, old school. But I remember him talking about pioneer spirit and talking about, you know, there's just a, you know, there's a way and that you go about doing these things. And he said, look, one of the things we talked about was, you know, fishermen know this. Farmers know this. There is a time to harvest. There's a time to plant. It sounds like a 60s song. But you have to repair the nets. If you don't, your tools break. Your body breaks. There's a time to rest. Usually they follow the seasons. But if you're not...
And the weather. Because that time changes.
And when it's time to harvest, you're harvesting 18 hours a day, 20 hours a day. It doesn't matter. Everybody is involved. And when the season's over, you rest. And if you never rest, or if you always rest, equal problems, different consequences, but equal problems. So I know we've been talking for a long time, and I could listen to you forever. I just want to say it's a remarkable story. I never saw it beginning in the Duncan Yo-Yo Championship. All the way to now, but to be so involved in so many, it's almost like Forrest Gump, to be so involved in so many of these things.
Well, you know the saying, you make your own luck.
Absolutely.
And one, two steps forward, one steps back. All those are true.
Yeah.
And I worked to do something.
Right.
That I would have fun doing, and other people would too.
Yeah.
If you enjoy what you're doing, you're going to do a good job. If you don't enjoy it, you're not going to be at your best ever.
I find that whether you're a person of faith or just a person that, you know, about karma, the universe is attracted to people that are about being about something, right?
Yeah.
Something bigger than themselves. And we all have moments of, you know, of it's not fair or this is hard or whatever. But when you're about, and I don't mean stupidly about, I don't mean ignorantly about. We see plenty of people that work really hard and then just run in circles and accomplish nothing. But when you are more about, at the end of the day, how do I get stuff done and bring people with me? How do I edify and bring people with me? Help them. J. Paul Getty once said, I'd rather have 1% of a million people than a million of one, right?
Yeah.
And he meant more than just how do I use people? How do I empower and help them accomplish what they want?
And what's done too often is what those two guys, two officers were doing with the sandbag.
That's right.
You're doing their job. You're thinking for them. Mm. Now you go do it.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. You know, what you want is input.
Mm-hmm.
Just mm-hmm. say, yeah, mm-hmm. good idea, go ahead.
Yeah.
Or, okay, but think about this.
Right.
And I never did any of the work.
Right. Well, don't tell them that. You got paid well. Heidi Heiden, thank you for coming on the QTS Experience.
It's been fun. And I will tell you that I do not do these things.
Well,
but Clint talked me into it. And he said, you're a good guy. So. And you are. So.
Well, thank you very much. It has been my great pleasure. I know my audience is going to love it. It's been a great journey. And one of these days in the future, I can't wait to talk about railroads and sailing. I got to believe that there are some stories in there that you've got.
Well, after I did really retire, I still can't get through the day without having everything I wanted to do done.
Right.
And I won't go into that, but maybe I have too many hobbies, maybe too many thoughts, too many interests. My wife says that all of that's true, but I'm still enjoying it.
Yeah.
And we're enjoying retirement now.
Yeah.
And,
well, if you've given this gift of life, which is a gift, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Live it. Live
Absolutely.
Your life. So many people are caught up in living someone else's life through technology, through something else, through watching it or whatever. I'm an optimist. I'm all about the technology, but I want it to enhance my life.
Well, you said live your life.
Live it.
Don't live somebody else's life.
Don't live someone else's life.
Live your own life.
That's right. Too hard to do.
Yes.
Sir, thank you so much for coming on. Really enjoyed it. All right, everybody. Thank you very much, Mr. Hyden. We'll see you.
Hey, this is David McCall with the QTS Experience. If you enjoy this conversation, please like, share, subscribe, and comment. See you next time.